continues tonight then. Clear, continued bitterly cold. Tonight's low, minus 10, with wind chills down to 25 below zero. And then on Friday, partly sunny, windy, very cold. Looks like an inch of snow on Friday. A high of 16, wind chills down to 20 below tomorrow. Currently, wind from the west at 9. 9 below for both Racine and Kenosha. 13 below for Burlington, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva. For WGTD News, I'm Dave McGrath. WGTD News time now, 10 past 8. The Morning Show with Greg Berg up next.
WGTD is supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information about undergraduate and adult education opportunities at carthage.edu. Support for the Morning Show also comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. This Saturday, Andrea's will host local author Craig Swanson. He'll be signing copies of his book, The Selma Campaign, Martin Luther King Jr., Jimmie Lee Jackson, and the Defining Struggle of the Civil Rights Era. That's this Saturday from noon to 2 at Andrea's.
And we welcome you to the Morning Show on WGTD-HD, your gateway to public radio. I'm Gregory Berg, and it is great to have with us, as we do each and every month, our good friend Nan Calvert, who helps share with us on a monthly basis some kind of story about environmental concerns. And so often, although certainly not always, it's a program which might be some kind of alarm call about some pressing issue about which we have to be worried and try to figure out what to do and so on. But often there are also very much feel-good stories. I mean, affirming, inspiring stories related to the natural world around us and what is being done to try to increase our sensitivity to the environment and the importance of its safekeeping. And towards that end, Nan Calvert has come up with what is an absolutely dynamite idea for today's morning show, a very much feel-good story. In fact, Nan, before we introduce our two guests, I want you to just say a word about who we're going to be talking with today and why. Why this folds so nicely into this concern.
Well, a few months back, we held a symposium, we being the Southeast Wisconsin Environmental Consortium. Invasive Species Consortium. And one of the advisors and three of the students from Escuela Verde were there. And they made themselves available to explain what they do and why they do and how they do it. And I've been riding around on this cloud of, inspiration, listening to their stories and what they've accomplished and how they approach education and how that education, how their programs are structured with these amazing pillars. I call them pillars or underpinnings of social justice, environmental justice, or sustainability, and just listening to how the students fully embody not only themselves but this program. It gives you hope, but it also invigorates you. It makes you want to do better and get out there and really interact with the world and support what's going on there. So that's why I wanted to have them on. I didn't know anything about them prior to that, and I feel lucky and I'm so thrilled to have made their acquaintances.
Very good. So we're talking about a school, a high school in Milwaukee.
Yes.
The first name of it again is?
Escuela Verde.
Escuela Verde. And we have from the staff there, Joey Zucker, who is an advisor there. And that title in and of itself is kind of intriguing. Explain to our listeners what that means, what you do there.
Sure. Well, as an advisor, our school is run by a teacher collective. So we don't have a principal. And we don't have typical teachers. Instead, as a project-based learning school, we have advisors, and we share collective administrative and teaching duties.
Hmm. So you are, as an advisor then, you are part of the time teaching, part of the time administering, doing all of that, and you're doing it, it sounds like, in very direct collaboration, cooperation with your colleagues.
Yes, with colleagues and with our students. So we try to empower our students to kind of own their own direction with their learning. And so the teaching is a unique form of teaching where we consider it kind of providing access to the educational resources that they're looking for.
And I don't think we've said this yet. What kind of a school is this in terms of private, public, parochial? Mm-hmm. What kind of a school is this?
Right. We are a 2-hour public charter school. So it's there's a lot of gray areas, in particular in the city of Milwaukee. So we are with the city of Milwaukee as our authorizer. We're a trans center for youth school, and they have 6 schools now that are underneath them, and they vary from MPS schools to all types of schools. So we are a public charter school, 7 through 12.
Very good. 7 through 12. And about how many students?
Right now we have about 75 students, and next year we are expanding, moving to a new building, and we'll have 100 students.
Very good. And I'm very, very happy that in our studios as well is one of the students at Escuela Verde, Ramon Rivera. Did I say that correctly?
Yeah.
Very good. Who is a senior there. And it's really good to have you here as well as to the morning show. We welcome you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah. So this is a school that has obviously a very exciting mission. When was it created?
We're in our 3rd year, so we're relatively new. Mm-hmm. But we definitely have evolved. One of our goals is we believe in praxis, so it's important to us to always change our vision and mission. In fact, every year we've done some slight changes, and we host a strategic planning session that includes our whole staff and seniors. So we go up and we do a 4-day retreat in northern Wisconsin, and the students spend some time evaluating and putting input into our vision and mission, as well as their own senior thesis project.
Wow. How did the school get put together? I mean, what was sort of the catalyst, and was anything or anyone kind of at the heart of bringing it into being?
Mm-hmm. It's a great question. I think, there was a group of us that taught together at a different school, and I was an MPS teacher for a little over 10 years before this school, teaching certified biology teacher. But I always kind of struggled with the idea of inquiry and teaching inquiry and how important that is, but our traditional models of education make it really difficult to teach student-driven inquiry, because it's just, by nature, it's a holistic approach, and you have to allow some time for freedom and exploration. And so I think the beginnings of our school were formed by a crew of us who were supporters of small schools in Milwaukee. And we worked at small MPS partnership schools, or just small MPS schools, and kind of watching the project-based schools getting shut down and small schools getting shut down. It's a hard mix for a large school district to be able to support small schools. They just are a different model. It's we definitely support large comprehensive high schools. I think there's a need for that, and that's the right fit for many of our students. But there's also a good fit for many of our learners who need that small, intimate kind of relationship as a driving force to their education. So I think there was a team of 3 or 4 of us who really worked hard together from our school that we saw was probably just not the right fit, because we still were bound by certain limitations. And we had this dream, and we found out that Trans Center for Youth had put in a request for this model. It's an Ed Visions model of teaching and education, and we realized that our model, we really wanted to use the Ed Visions model with incorporating education for sustainability and social justice and restorative justice. And we felt like it was a very natural fit. And so when we found out that school was approved, we approached Trans Center and the executive director, Dan, and said, hey, we have this team. Do you have a team to lead this school? And he said, yeah, take it. So it worked out really well for us.
Wow. So the concept, in a sense, already existed. and you thought that that concept or that model fit very well your own vision, but, and it could be, in a sense, adapted for particularly this vision of a school in which sustainability and social justice and were at the epicenter of it.
Yes. Yeah.
Wow, that's quite a story, isn't it?
It is.
So Nan, you didn't know anything about this before you met the folks from Escuela Baby.
No, nothing at all. Sad to say, and I think far too many people don't know about it. And it was funny during the symposium because those of us who were organizing the symposium and hosting the symposium kept whispering to each other during their presentation, it makes me want to go back to high school and do it all over again because it's just such a completely sort of mind-blowing approach to learners. I love it when they use the word learners, and then to connect or to help to connect everybody to the natural world at large, which is the basis of everything we do, no matter what you do. That doesn't happen really anywhere else. We all wanted to go back to school, and we all wanted to transform all of the high schools out there because it's such an amazing concept, you know. And to really direct people toward, what are your strengths? What are your passions? And how do you achieve that? And how do you also keep in your mind your relationship with the earth, with the natural world, whether you're going to be an ornithologist or you're going to be a designer or you're going to be a parent or whatever it is that you're going to be, that is incorporated into that worldview, which is just fantastic.
As opposed to this array of concerns being sort of kept in its own little compartment, very discreet from other things that we talk about or think about.
And de-emphasized.
Well, right. I mean, almost unavoidably de-emphasized because of that. I mean, it's funny because I think some people might think, oh, no, you put it in this special little box and that it's this special little concern. But just by putting it in that box, you're limiting the possibilities.
Yeah. And it's only for the crunchy granola people and the science nerds and right. people who wear Birkenstocks and everybody else does something
different. Yeah, all the normal people do their normal thing. So, I know what you're saying. Ramon, tell us how this ended up being the choice for you. You were saying a little bit about this before we went on the air. Explain to our listeners how you came to find yourself at Escuela Verde.
Well, my freshman year, I got accepted to Marquette University High School, and that's where I was. And then what had happened after that is some family issues kind of, kicked up in the dirt, and I had to move out up north towards West Bend, Kewaskum area. I was up there for about a year. And then when things started settling down, back in Milwaukee, my family was like, okay, you can come back now. So I came back and it was mid-February and MPS was, we can't really take you right now because we don't really have room. And I didn't want to wait a whole semester to go back to school because that would have set me back so far.
And yet you wanted to be back home in Milwaukee.
Yeah.
Right.
And so we started, doing a little more research and looking for schools. And just that year, Escuela Verde had opened. That was their first year open. And it was in their, second semester. And so we checked it out, and me and my family went down there, and we, filled out the application and had an interview and everything. And the next day they called us back and, hey, Ramon, why don't you come in on to school? You know, you're a part of us now. So
as simple as that. And do I remember you saying that they were right down the street from where you lived? I mean, really, really close.
Yeah,
right?
they're within walking distance for sure. They're 3 blocks away.
Wow. So right, practically right under your noses. And this was, you were getting it on the ground floor. The school had just begun then.
Yes. So I was part of the guinea pig batch.
Right. So
the experimental
the
days.
The world is an experiment.
Right, yeah. So how small did this school begin? Did you have 75 students right from the start?
We started with 65.
Wow, pretty substantial start. Mm-hmm. How does one sort of get the word out? I mean, how are you able to draw? I mean, that I'm honestly a little surprised you were able to, right off the bat, have that many students. How did you manage in terms of just launching to attract enough students to make it viable from the start?
I think school startups are always tricky because it's Well, you know, it is a what did you say, the guinea pigs? You know, it's a risk,
yeah.
And it's a risk for students and parents to take a startup program, any startup program, because you don't know where it's going to lead. For us, we advertise locally. So we spent a lot of time just flyering the local. We want a real community feel. We went to different events that focused on sustainability, knowing that our focus was on that. And we did some, I mean, really, it was a lot of word of mouth. We found a couple of parents who were excited and understood the vision and mission, and then just helped, you know, spread the word and try to get a good population in. I mean, it's open to the public, and so we put it on all the public feeds, and parents are looking for options, I think.
Sure. Ramon, do you recall that this was a quick match? I mean, did you fall in love with the school, you and your family, right from the start, or did you not at first know quite what to make of it?
I think right from the start, I was just like, this is my school. This is where I'm supposed to be.
Really?
You know, it had a different feel to it, and since it was project-based, that's what I was used to in middle school. And so I guess, like, coming in, I was like, this is familiar to me. This is safe ground. And, you know, having advisors that care and want to know who you are and where you come from and help you excel in the areas that you're best, I think it was, like, the key thing for me.
Hmm. I can imagine.
Ramon, would you say you've changed since you've been at Escuela Verde?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I think I've grown. I mean, there's a bunch of different areas that I've grown in. I think speaking, I've grown, like, fluently with my vocabulary and how extensive it's become. But not only that, but I feel as a person I've grown. You know, coming in my sophomore year, I was, you know, very boisterous and a little over outgoing. And I think, you know, EV's helped me tone that down a little bit and, you know, redirect it in a way that I can positively put it out there without overdoing it.
Mm-hmm. Now, of course, when you choose a school like Escuela Verde, then you're presumably, although correct me if I'm wrong, you're probably giving up certain things that a lot of high school students like. I mean, like playing football or marching in the marching band or whatever it might be. Were any of those issues for you or not particularly?
I mean, yeah, I'm a big sports guy. I'm not the smallest guy in the world. But, yeah, coming in, you know, not having sports there was an issue for me, I guess. But the cool thing about it is if you can find enough people to support you and you can find a way to do it, you can do almost anything you want at Escuela Verde. So me and a couple other students and with staff help created a boys basketball team and a girls volleyball team, and now we have a co-ed soccer team that'll be starting this spring. Mm-hmm. So
you made it happen.
Yeah.
In some ways, that's even more exciting than going someplace where something already exists. You had to make this happen right from the start.
Mm-hmm.
How exciting. Joy Zucker, you are one of the advisors there at Escuela Verde. In terms of what the school offers academically, is it the full range of typical programming? I mean, math and science and English and history and so on. I mean, does your curriculum otherwise at a glance look dramatically different from that of a more typical school?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, the standards, the students are required with the same state standards. In fact, they have a few additional graduation requirements, like a one-credit portfolio of life. They are required to do service learning, a half a credit of service learning, and they have a capstone three-credit senior thesis project that's Youth Participatory Eco-Justice Action Research. So the students have to basically, when they're seniors, and Ramon has one, come up with an issue they see in the community and then propose a solution, actually take action to implement that solution, and then figure out how they're going to, you know, measure the results of their action, reflect on it, and write a research paper. So I think if you look at our credit requirements, we use the Common Core standards, we use the Next Generation Science standards, but what's different is the students create their courses, and they have to figure out what it is exactly that they're going to do to reach those standards.
So, Joey Zucker, would you say that most of the students who come to Escuela Verde, walk in the door already to some extent in this mindset of caring about social justice, caring about the environment, as often as not, do you have students who aren't particularly inclined in that direction, and mm-hmm. and for whom this school is a place where those interests are maybe seriously awakened for the very first time? How would you characterize your student body in that respect?
I think our student body, I would definitely say they don't come in where we imagine that we want them to evolve to. We want us to evolve to as well. I think that just coming into a project-based learning school, we take the Edvisions approach where it's about one month to 1 year to unlearn the old traditional way. You know, you sit down, a teacher tells you what to do, you fill it out, you turn it in, you get a grade back, and that's the way it rolls. For us, we really spend a lot of time, and we have a forgiveness period of students who are learning, and we have to scaffold where they learn how to be self-directed. As far as the sustainability and justice goes, I think that the students come in interested in it. I would say the majority of them don't have a lot of experience with it, but they understand that that's part of the vision and mission of our school. Before they come in, we make it very clear that this is what we're about. In particular, the social justice aspect, we don't practice zero tolerance. We practice restorative justice. So if there's an issue, and there's issues, we're all human. We all talk about it. If there's an issue, then we have a group of students who are trained in as circle keepers, who help with kind of mediation of peacekeeping. And so if you do something, we talk a lot about dignified interactions, and that can mean a lot of things. And if somebody has an issue that needs to be addressed, we call a circle, and circle keepers are a part of that. And we address the issue. We talk about what harm was done, and we talk about ways to repair the harm. That's probably the biggest transition for a lot of students. They're used to just being suspended, and they come the next day, they get angry, they go home, they come back, everything's fine. And we don't work like that, because we always say we're a small family. We're kind of a one-room schoolhouse, and if there's an issue, everybody's going to know about it. You can't come back the next day and have it just be swept under the rug. And so we work on talking about the issues and helping each other evolve into people who are able to take criticism and provide good constructive ways to help us move forward into being whole people. And this is true with advisors as well. There's times where students will say, I feel like, you know, Joey's really approaching me in a way that's making me really mad, and we need to talk. And so then a student can call that on an advisor, and then we'll sit down and we'll talk about approach and what, you know, and Ramon and I have probably had these talks, the two of us sitting here in the past. And, and you know, I'll say, Ramon will tell me, I get frustrated. Can you help me out here? What can I do differently? And he'll say, well, it's a good question. You know, I don't know, you know, but then he'll say, I need you to give, you know, approach me and ask me to come over here, and then give me a couple of minutes to cool down and then come back, you know, or something where we're thinking about what's happening instead of just reacting.
Ramon's nodding his head vigorously, actually. So is this a big part of your story at Escuela Verde?
I mean, we all have our bad days. Me, I had a little more.
You had
a few
plenty.
More times. I've had plenty. Okay. I've had a couple bad days. But I think at the end of the day, it's you look around and see that we are one small community with only 75 students in the whole school. You do one thing and everybody knows you, and they mark you as that. And I feel, you know, you have to resolve the issue in a way that people know you cared enough about it to bring it up yourself instead of having somebody come and approach you and say, you know, you did that yesterday. We need to have this talk. Like in a normal high school, they'd be like, you did this yesterday, we're going to come to the office, you're probably going to get suspended or, you know, detention. But I think sitting down and actually talking about the problem, where it, you know, came from, how did it escalate to this point, what really caused it, is there something else behind this that's really causing this, or is it just you acting out?
And can you see a fairly dramatic difference in yourself from where you were then to where you are now in this particular respect?
Yeah, definitely. I feel, you know, these circles really open you up and make you think about your actions. A principal can sit and tell you, oh, what happened? Well, this guy did this to me and I did that back. And you're not getting into why I reacted or why I am so reactive. And that was a huge part of, you know, growing, is looking at myself and reflecting on the issue and reflecting on, was it me personally or was it this other person that, you know, pulled something out of me that I didn't know I had?
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Very well put.
When we were at the symposium listening to the students, I had about a million questions flying around in my head. And one of the questions I asked the three students there was, how have you changed, or how are you different compared to your friends or siblings who are not attending Escuela Verde? How has it shaped you? And it was such a fascinating answer. One of the young men, and unfortunately I don't have their names with me, but one of the young men said, it's changed me in such a way that I notice things, and I'll always notice things. I notice the birds singing. I notice a plant here. And I believe he said he wanted to be a designer, but he said, I know that when I have a family, I'm going to teach them to notice things too.
Mm.
The other young man said, I'm going to be an ornithologist. You know, I mean, it just the impact that this school has on young people, that opens them to, you know, communicating in a mutual way, to peaceful resolution of things, to coming together and living as a community, and in a bigger community at large, you know, in the world. It's just an amazing thing to me. And the opportunities that it exposes them to, because many of the students that come live in a very, very urban environment. I mean, it's paved over. There are tall buildings, and there's not a lot of, you know, green growing things and all those kinds of things. So to hear a young man say, you know, he was going to be a scientist and he was going to be an ornithologist, my gosh, that's amazing.
It's sort of the last thing you think is going to spring up in the middle of a city like Milwaukee.
Exactly. You'd think, well, I'm going to be an urban planner, or I'm going to be a software designer, or, you know, something of that.
Or a basketball star.
Exactly.
We all dream. But, yeah, Ramon, before you came to Escuela Verde, how would you describe your relationship with, for instance, the natural world, and how much you ever thought about environmental issues and so on? You know, where were you then, and where are you now?
Coming in, you know, my family has always owned land. We've always been up north in the woods and doing stuff. So, you know, I had an idea of what it was to, you know, kind of preserve the land that had already been there, and, you know, instead of paving it over. But I don't think I paid that much attention to, you know, what kind of tree this was and how it actually affected my ecosystem around me. And, you know, how, you know, if one plant dies out, then this whole species could go extinct, or this whole specific, like, plant goes extinct, then it could affect everything. Like, I didn't see that. I just was like, oh, a deer. Oh, it's going to get chased down by a coyote or a wolf, and it's going to get eaten. That's the way it works. But I think, you know, now I look at things a little clearer, and I see them from a different perspective. And that's one of the sustainability themes at our school, is multiple perspectives. Mm-hmm. And so seeing something from somebody else's point of view really opens your eyes and lets you see what they see and why they care so much about this stuff. So,
And, you know, it's interesting. You brought up curriculum earlier, and I think for us, we're a meld of a lot of things. And, of course, we understand what world we live in, and that we want our students, when they graduate, to have choices. So our students have gotten into college. Those who want to go are going to college, and we want them to be prepared for that as an option. However, we also, you know, our ultimate goal, our vision is to cultivate a community that's participatory, just, sustainable, and peaceful. And we want our graduates to live happy, healthy, meaningful lives. And so what that means to them. But with this, and this concept of participation and justice and sustainability and peace, we kind of have these overarching curricular lenses of course, the environment, but it's, you know, we go to Jones Island, we see what happens when you flush the toilet and where things are actually going, and we talk a lot about our water cycle and all of these things that are absolutely important. But we also talk about justice, because when we talk about the biggest issue of our time, you know, climate change, right? Climate change can't climate change is in the next generation science standards, right? There's learning targets that say, talk about climate change and how that's impacting the Earth, okay? But you can't get that in just a science, like that is huge. And if we really want to impact it, we have to be thinking about what kind of students do we really need? We need students who don't just understand what happens when they throw something away or recycle something, but we also need our students to get to a point where they have a voice and where they are comfortable with their voice, where they think about what's meaningful for them and where they are willing to step into an arena where they might be against the dominant feelings because they feel like it's right, right? Our whole society is going to need to change in order to address what we're doing to our climate, especially as Americans. And the, you know, the dominant white culture is like a huge driving force behind that. So in the past, and I've been part of my, I have my master's in environmental education. I've been part of the Wisconsin Environmental Education Association for a long time. And in the past 20 years, there's been a lot of times where our environmental educators really focused on rural or suburban areas. And it was like, get out into the forest and learn how to measure trees. And we do that, actually, you know, but the shift is coming now, finally, where they're recognizing the importance of our urban populations. And to me, when we think about how hard it's going to be to train our society to really change, how everything we're doing, who's better equipped than our young students who are already seeing they don't quite have a right niche in our dominant society? They're already realizing, you know, you see a group of non-white, large black men like, you know, Ramon, and he's always like, I'm not even black, but that's what people see, right? They see dark skin and they have this fear. He's used to that and he's training himself to say, I know that when somebody meets me, they're going to have assumptions about me and I'm going to change their mind and I'm going to show them who I really am and what I'm really about and my character. And so they're already used to this resistance. They're super resilient. They're passionate. They want to see change. They're our best equipped change makers, I think, are these young kids who are already fighting the fight, so to speak.
And I think that's what our senior thesis is really about. Mm-hmm. I mean, each student has a senior thesis, or each senior will eventually be each student, but each student or senior has a senior thesis that we have to do. It's a 3-credit project, and they really choose something that they most identify with or that they feel that they can help with. And so mine was, how does education on about segregation and racism affect multicultural relationships? And, you know, me, kind of how Joey explained it, being like identified as like a African-American male in today's society just by like people in public when they see me, they're like, whoa, that's a really tall black guy.
Yeah, right.
That's a really big black guy.
Right.
Like, that's, yeah, we got to kind of walk around him. He's kind of big and like scary looking.
Right, right.
I'm not, guys. I'm really loving. I promise. But that's what really drove me to do this project, is to educate people and say, this is why certain people act this way. This is why the society is this way, is because of these events that happened here, here, and here that drove people to be this way and this way. And, you know, it's just, I think I wouldn't have thought of even pursuing an idea to research or even think about it a little more if I wasn't at EV.
Right. And it's probably the kind of thing you might have been more apt to just accept it, that that's the way it is. That's the hand I've been dealt, or that's just the world in which I live. And you actually have the notion that this world can be changed for the better. And you're going to be one of the people who does it, who helps the change.
That is true.
What else, Ramon, about Escuela Verde has been important to you and to your schoolmates in terms of the way they approach education and what kind of a difference it has made for you?
I think being self-driven is a huge aspect. They really don't push us to do our work. They do. Don't get me wrong. They do push us. But it's in a different way than you'd expect. Like, for you to come in as a, if you come in as a seventh grader, they're going to kind of walk with you. But as you get older and your grade changes and you start getting older and aging, they kind of start separating from you and giving you more separation, more distance, more freedom. And, you know, I'm in my senior year where I'm doing basically anything I want. Like, last Friday, I had permission to go to a seminar at Marquette University and miss a whole day of school because I've proven myself to be, you know, to get this freedom. And it's, I think this school is one of, like, the top for, like, college-level work, because if I'm doing a 300, like, a three-credit project right now, and I'm in high school and I have to do research, I have to collect data, I have to analyze this data, you know, I have to give a 10-minute presentation or 15-minute presentation at the end of the year, you know, and write a 10 to 15-page paper.
That's big-time stuff.
Yeah.
And the fact that it's set up in such a way that you have to show tremendous initiative.
Exactly.
None of this is being handed to you, and you're learning so much about the collaboration and so on.
Mm-hmm.
What I was impressed with during their presentation at CWISC was the field research that they do, actual, real, hardcore science field research. And Joey can speak to that certainly much more eloquently than I can.
Mm-hmm. I mean, we have three kind of workshops that run throughout the year. One is our field research team. The other is our circle keepers, which I mentioned. And then the third is our youth activists. And students can sign up for these workshops. And the field research team basically collaborates a lot with the Urban Ecology Center and the DNR. And really, we just look at research that needs to be done that isn't being done in our urban parks. So our students go out and they collect water samples and they, you know, help remove invasive species, or they plant native plants. But the key thing is they're doing something that is already a need that people have said, you know, we need to study these things so that their data is going into the pool. You know, they do eBird, or they do anytime they're collecting samples, it goes beyond just a homework assignment that they're turning in. It's contributing back with citizen science research to the research pool. And that's part of, you know, we talk a lot about our students, especially high schoolers, oh, well, you'll know more when you get older, or you're going to be happy you did this for when you start your real world. And, you know, we're like, this is the real world, and we're in it right now, and they're more than capable of creating change and contributing right now to what we're all doing.
So. Today is the day.
Right.
Ramon, what are your hopes for next year once you graduate? First of all, that's going to be a hard day, isn't it? I have a feeling it's not going to be an easy goodbye for you versus, you know, the way it is for maybe other high school students. I mean, I think a lot of high schoolers are sad to see high school end, but for many, that's a joyous day. I suspect when you are graduating from this small, tight community, it represents something else. It's not going to be easy.
Yeah, I think I'm going to cry a little bit. In all honesty, I probably will. But the cool thing is I'm staying in Milwaukee. I'm going to college. I got accepted to UWM and Marquette University. Still have to decide yet. But, you know, always, you know, being in Milwaukee still, I'm going to come back, visit, volunteer, kind of give what I can back to the school for them helping me grow.
I imagine that's exactly what's going to happen.
Mm-hmm.
Joey, if people are intrigued to know even more about the school beyond what we have talked about today, and certainly we've explored all kinds of exciting things that are going on there, what should they do?
Well, you can always check out our website at www.escuelaverde.org. There's contact information on there. We do have a calendar of events. We have tour dates set up. We have opportunities for the community to volunteer. We collaborate with a lot of different organizations and people in our community. We wouldn't be where we are if we didn't have all of the support. So I think getting online or is probably the best way, and there's lots of different email addresses there. And reach out, come and visit us. We have community nights, presentation nights that are all open to the public, and even just stopping by and checking it out. We have student ambassadors who give tours, so that you get the real scoop from the students themselves.
I am one of those student ambassadors. You can meet me.
Wow. Well, I think a lot of people would like to do just that beyond what we've had today. Joey Zocker, Ramon Rivera, a great privilege and pleasure to meet both of you and to learn more about the exciting work that is being done at Escuela Verde. So thank you so much for being here. And Ramon, very best wishes to you as you go on from here to, I'm sure, exciting and important things.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Nan, what a great idea. I'm so glad you made this happen.
Thank you.
Let's finish up with whatever calendar events you want to tell us about.
Doesn't it make you want to do and do high school all
it
over
does,
again?
It does, actually. Okay. It really, truly does.
I never thought I would ever say that. Okay, so here we go. Yes, we have important announcements. On February 22nd, there will be a free and open to the public open house at Sino Conservancy. It starts at 11 in the morning and ends up at about 4 p.m. Smokey the Bear will be our special guest. We will have food and guided tours. We will have all kinds of things for you to do. There will be tasty treats. It's going to be lots and lots of fun. We'll have a display and an expert on our native pollinators there. So please do come out for the open house. If you have any questions, call 539-3222. Riverbend Nature Center will begin its sugaring off programs on March 1st with pancakes and maple syrup, and that will continue every Sunday through March 22nd, and that happens at 9 in the morning until 1 p.m. After breakfast, volunteers will lead you on a hike to observe and learn the process of collecting maple sap and then turning it into maple syrup. Tickets can be purchased at the door. And then Hoy Audubon, our friends from Hoy Audubon, on Saturday, February 21st at 9 in the morning, there will be a field trip to the Racine Lakefront to observe and learn about waterfowl and gulls. It begins at Myers Park. And dress for the weather, bring your binoculars, and just contact Hoy Audubon if you have any questions. Go to their website, and all their contact information is there. And that's it.
Very good. Nan Calvert, thank you. Forward to seeing you next month.
Yes, we'll be here.
I'm Greg Reberg. The time is 8:51, and you're listening to The Morning Show on WGTD-HD, Kenosha, Racine, Elkhorn, and Lake Geneva, your gateway to public radio, and here is part two of today's program. To finish out today's morning show, we're going into the archives for a conversation with Dr. Lisa Young, the author of a book called The Portion Teller, Smart Size Your Way to Permanent Weight Loss. It is Dr. Young's contention that the single leading cause of obesity in the United States is the escalation of portion size. And we see that whenever we go into just about any fast food restaurant or into any convenience store, we are confronted by huge portions like we did not see 15, 20 years ago. And it is her contention that nothing is a more significant contributor to the obesity epidemic here in the United States than this. Her book is an effort to talk about this, to bring it before the public, and to help people understand the significance of portion control. The book is published by Crown Archetype.
You know, it is amazing how portion sizes have grown so much in the past 30 years and how people have gained weight in parallel. The average adult has gained 8 pounds beginning in the 1980s, and that is just at the same time that portions began to explode. So I realize that in treating people and in counseling people, it's not so much what they eat that they need to worry about, but it's how much they eat. And in The Portion Teller, I've devised a plan, a user-friendly visual guide to help people, A, estimate portions, and B, determine their portion personality and their eating style so that they can lose weight permanently and keep it off.
Hmm. We should mention the photograph of you, which is on the back flap of your book's cover, because right there we see a perfect example of what you're talking about in terms of the explosion in the size of portions.
Oh, absolutely. You see a soda cup that is 64 ounces, a half gallon of soda, marketed for just one person that contains nearly 800 calories and 50 teaspoons of sugar.
Mm.
That's unbelievable.
Well, and then next to it, next to that double gulp from 7-Eleven are soda cups, which are in descending size towards something that's a little more normal, including a you know, kind of a normal styrofoam cup at the far left. And we just kind of see right there a very graphic indication of how portion size has really exploded over recent years.
Oh, absolutely. And that styrofoam cup used to be a standard size. Now you can't find that anywhere.
The small styrofoam cups we grew up with, you mean?
Right, right. Now you don't get that. If you were to buy that in a, you know, in a restaurant or any place, you would feel gypped. you'd feel like, oh, I need to call the portion police.
Yeah, right. You know, it's interesting. The convenience store right down the road from the studio here, the radio studio, during the summer, they have a special of any size soda, 69 cents. And I'm sure many people opt for the, I think their largest happens to be 44 ounces, which is a lot of soda.
That's a lot of soda.
And because they have this one price for any of them, of course, many people will gravitate towards the largest for the sake of the bargain, even though they are doing themselves some harm.
That's what it is. We really, in America, want a deal. We want a bargain. But what we don't realize is at the end of the day, we're not getting a health bargain. We're gaining weight, and there's lots of consequences that go along with that, not just that the pants are too tight. You've got diabetes, and you've got heart disease.
Hmm. Tell our listeners about the Portion Museum, which you assembled as you began studying this in a serious way.
Oh, okay. The Portion Museum is, as I was getting my PhD in nutrition at NYU, and I was specifically focusing on how portion sizes have grown enormously. And before I started my research, it just hit me to kind of go around the streets and look to see all of the things that have gotten bigger. So I was taking pictures, I was collecting things. For example, you go to Starbucks, you want the small coffee, what do you get tall? The smallest is tall. I found bagels the size of seat cushions. I found muffins that were so enormous. Everything around us has gotten big. You know, a Big Mac, which used to be big back in 1968, is only 3 ounces. You can get a half a pound burger.
Hmm.
You could actually get two-thirds of a pound if you go to Hardee's. So
Everything
I've tracked has gotten bigger, and it wasn't just one food. I mean, it was even beer cans, a 24-ounce beer can, beer bottles, and I was collecting these things, movie theater containers. It was like a horse feed, not a portion for one person. And that's what really led me to say, wait a minute, we need to educate the public not on what they eat, but on how much they eat. And the key to permanent weight loss is learning to scale back on how much we eat. And in the Portion Teller, I developed a visual program to help people with that information. I don't ask them to weigh their foods or measure their foods because that's not going to work. But think a deck of cards, 3 ounces. Think a shot glass of salad dressing. You know, that's 2 tablespoons. It's much more user-friendly, and it will work in the long term.
Hmm. You know, that brings up to something that you call a portion distortion.
Ugh.
That's at that point in the book when you're kind of showing us, and there's big, long, fascinating lists of what you call portion shockers of exactly what you were talking about. And one of the consequences you tell us is that we lose all sense of what small, medium, and large even means. I mean, those adjectives are meaningless when it comes to something as important as portion control. And in a sense, then, your book imposes a different way to think beyond those now meaningless terms, like what's a small, what's a medium, what's a large.
Yeah, those terms are totally meaningless. And you go into a place and you say, ooh, I'll have the small or the kitty, and you think you're being virtuous. But the kitty size today is what the large used to be back in the 50s.
Hmm.
You know, it's unbelievable how much portions have grown and how our perception has then changed once we're in the home as well.
Hmm.
And that's the scary part. We're buying bigger plates, 25%. Plates have grown in size by 25%. We're buying bigger mugs, bigger glasses, and, of course, we pile more food on. And research clearly shows that we eat more when we're presented with a bigger portion.
Right. You mentioned at one point in the book two terms which we are probably a bit too sloppy with, a serving versus a portion.
Exactly.
What is the most important distinction for us to know there?
The most important distinction is everybody thinks that an appropriate amount of food is a portion, what you're served in the restaurant. But what you're served in the restaurant has nothing to do with how much you should eat, and how much you should eat is a serving.
Dr. Lisa Young's book is called The Portion Teller, Smart Size Your Way to Permanent Weight Loss. And she has written a second book since this interview was recorded, a book called The Portion Teller Plan, The No Diet Reality Guide to Eating, Cheating, and Losing Weight Permanently, published by Crown. Tomorrow on The Morning Show, a conversation with one of the country's leading experts on diabetes. Support for the Morning Show comes from Andrea's, a Kenosha tradition since 1911. This Saturday, Andrea's will host local author Craig Swanson. He'll be signing copies of his book, The Selma Campaign, Martin Luther King Jr., Jimmie Lee Jackson, and the defining struggle of the Civil Rights Era. That's this Saturday from noon to 2 at Andrea's. WGTD is also supported by Carthage College, dedicated to combining an environment of reflection and self-discovery with a culture of high expectation, designed to allow students to uncover and ignite their potential. More information